Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Area Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. And before we get to Dorsey Hager, the Columbus Central Ohio building trades, I mentioned at the top of the show that Scabby the Rat has won again on Tuesday. Members of the National Labor Relations Board have affirmed again the lawfulness of Scabby the Rat. This was a unanimous opinion. Members McFerrin, Ring, and Kaplan held that the board's administrative law judge erred in finding that the rat's deployment against a so-called neutral firm violated the National Labor Relations Act ban on secondary boycotts, noting that protesting the neutral's dealings with unnamed rat contractors. I can't believe I'm saying this. Unnamed rat contractors was distinct from the union's dispute over recognition with the primary employer. This case, which involved the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 150, was one of several prepared by former general counsel Peter Robb in his quest to ban the rat from union protests. The case marks the third time since July to uphold Local 150's use of Scabby the Rat. Dorsey Hager, I have to ask you about these unnamed rat contractors. I'm sure there have been many in your line of work. How are you doing today, brother?
Doing great. Scabby the Rat has made many of an appearance in Columbus and Central Ohio. So, yeah, I'm glad to see that he's still alive and well and making his way to non-union job sites to protest and bring to light some of the poor working conditions and wages that some of these contractors pay their open shops. So glad Scabby the Rat has survived the Trump administration.
Yes,
tried to put the nail in his coffin. You know, Peter Robb, a high profile, you know, anti-union lawyer, you know, Trump just really stacked that NLRB board. And as soon as President Biden was elected, that was the first thing he did, was got rid of all those people and totally revamped it, which is great for organized labor. Great for all workers in the country, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have a very, very pro-labor National Labor Relations Board. I mean, they put labor back into it. It was anti-labor for years, not even just under Trump. I mean, even during the Bush administration, it was rough, you know, from both Bush administrations. But times have changed, definitely in Washington. All right, you wanted to talk about the Ohio State Building Trades Convention. In fact, we're going to pick up on this with Mike Nisley. He's going to be joining us later in the show. But I'd like to get your perspective on it. Go ahead.
I thought it was a great convention. We had delegates from all around the state, from all the trades, come into Columbus. It was at the Hilton downtown. We started with our board meetings and committee meetings on Sunday. Monday was speeches, resolutions, took care of some business. Tuesday we finished up with the election, the VPs, the president, and the executive secretary, treasurer. Mike's going to be on your show, so obviously he was reelected. Congratulations to him. Congratulations from Mark Douglas from the IBEW. He was reelected as president. But I thought Mike and Mark, Matt Salazzi from ACT Ohio, did a great job with the whole convention. We heard a great legislative update from Matt Salazzi. He spoke to the delegates for about an hour, hour and a half. Mark Johnson, who's head of the Tri-State Building Trades, and he's also a representative in the State House, I think out of the 92nd District. He spoke about current legislation and some of the things that he's doing to educate his caucus members down at the State House and educate others about, you know, organized labor. He gave a great speech. Of course, both of our senators spoke, Rob Portman and Sherrod Brown, and, you know, Sherrod Brown did a wonderful job. Frank LaRose spoke, and he talked about the integrity of elections and how the elections were ran really well here in Ohio. And we just had a great group of speakers. It was nice to reconnect and catch up with everybody, you know, from Marietta, Cincinnati, Toledo, Cleveland, all four corners, and it was good spending a couple of days there at the Ohio State Building Trades Convention in Columbus.
You mentioned Frank LaRose in voting, and I'm just wondering, did any conversation come up? I know it went well in the state of Ohio, but that being said, there's a lot of states that are really, really clamping down on voting. Did that come up in the conversation at all?
No, it didn't come up at all. And, you know, there were very, very few cases. I can't remember how many. He said how many, and it was very, very low. There was very, very few cases of voter fraud in last year's election, which, you know, was a presidential election, record amount of turnout in the state of Ohio. I think over 4.6 million people voted in the state of Ohio. So, no, he didn't talk about any of the election laws or anything like that. He did, you know, just like I said, say that there was a few cases of voter fraud, but I can't remember how many, but it was very, very low, very, very low. And, you know, it seems like the mail-in balloting and all that worked really well last year across the state. And I think that helped with the turnout, especially in a pandemic. And I hope it's something that we can continue on. The one thing that I was talking about to a few political friends of mine the other day, which I was disappointed in, is I remember Ohio used to have a 10-day window where you could go in and register an early vote at the same time. And unfortunately, the legislature did take that away. And I thought that that was a great tool to be used, you know, when we were trying to get our members registered to vote, that they could go in, have that 10-day window of both registration and early voting to make it convenient so they could go in, register, vote the same day. But, you know, they took that away. So now you have to register by October 4th. For this year's election. And then, you know, I think the early voting starts the next day, and you can vote early in person or absentee ballot all the way up until election day, which, you know, is November 2nd. So that's the only thing that I've seen that's been restrictive here recently in Ohio's voting laws. But you are right. A lot of states around the country are copying Texas voter restriction laws in Georgia, and they're looking to do the same thing in their states because they would like to, you know, like to tamp down some of the turnout.
Oh, it's up to, I believe, 18 states right now that have clamped down. You you mentioned this took place at the Hilton Hotel in Columbus. I'm just wondering, and I know past conventions, past years, everything's been done virtually here. How did that go, and how was the attendance? I'm just wondering, because we're still in this pandemic.
Yeah, we're still in this pandemic. As you know, there's a mask mandate in the city of Columbus. Mayor Ginther, by executive order, did a mask mandate. And then when city council came out of summer recess, they adopted the legislation. So there is a mask mandate in all public spaces. You know, I haven't heard of anybody getting sick coming out of the convention. It seems like everybody was good and well. You know, we had social distance. You know, I don't want to say 100%, but almost everybody was wearing masks. Plenty of room in the ballroom that we were in for the meeting, so we were all kind of spread out and stuff. But I think it went really well. I think it was done safely. You know, it was great that we could have it because, you know, we missed it last year because of the pandemic, so we were off a year on the schedule. But, yeah, I think it was great that we had the convention, and I think it was done pretty safely. And everybody came out of there pretty happy, I think. So
Good. All right, the other thing you wanted to talk about was Issue 7, and this was to vote no on Issue 7. You got to tell me what's going on there in Central Ohio with this issue.
Yeah, so we were just talking about voting in elections, and I mean, we have some important races here in Columbus, even though it's a municipal year and people don't always understand that elections aren't every 4 years, they're every year. We have some very important races here in Columbus. Shannon Harden, Nick Bankston, Lourdes de Perosa, De Padilla are on the ballot for city council. Nick and Lourdes will be replacing two longstanding members of city council, Mitch Brown and Priscilla Tyson. Shannon Harden is up for re-election. He's the president of council, so he's kind of leading the charge to get the team elected and get them across the finish line and get them re-elected. But we've endorsed all three of those. We're trying to be as helpful as we can. There's numerous judge races, municipal judge races, and you and I have talked at length on this show about how important judicial races are. So there's a lot of judicial races that are incredibly important that we've got to let our members know about. But the other one, and I did a press conference with the mayor 2 weeks ago and also leaders, community leaders from Central Ohio. The Issue 7 is a dark money group, I believe out of Indiana, has came in, got signatures, got on the ballot. And basically if Issue 7 were to pass, then the city of Columbus would have to give about $90 million a year out of their city budget to this dark money group to basically run Columbus's energy policy. So on the outskirts, it looks good because you're like, oh, here, this group's going to run Columbus's clean energy projects. But it's a bad bad piece of legislation that, if passed, would take effect, because there's, you know, like, there's five people to this group. One person that's on there doesn't even know who the group is. They haven't had any meetings. It just seems like a power grab or a big money grab. And this group that's done this has done this, I think, in 17 cities across the country. I don't know if they've been successful yet, but they've done this across the country. So we're working with city leaders. We're working with community leaders. We're working with labor and other leaders of business around Columbus Central Ohio. We're trying to raise money. We're trying to get out to let people know that this is no good. I just had a meeting a couple days ago where I discussed this with President Watson from the NAACP. She's going to try to get her members out to vote no on this, but also to encourage their friends and family members to vote no as well. Because, you know, municipal elections, I mean, I'll be shocked if we hit 8% participation in the city of Columbus. I hope it's higher, but there's just very low turnout on municipal elections. We got to make sure people turn out to not only support the candidates that support labor, but also to vote no on this issue 7, which could be devastating to the city and the city budget. You know, if you take $90 million out of the city budget, the budget every year is a little under $1 billion. You're looking at cuts to police, fire, safety. You're also looking at huge cuts to the capital improvement budget, which is going to have a direct effect on my members, because there's going to be less projects to build and maintain, less bridges, less roads, all that stuff that we do in the city of Columbus to help this city grow and improve. And it's just going to be a devastating effect. So anytime I can speak about it, I'm out speaking. Make sure that we're going to vote no on issue 7.
Any polling on this issue to give you an indication of how much support it has in that area, Dorsey?
Yeah, so the polling I've seen, it's about 50-50 right now. But if and I say we because we endorse it, so I consider myself part of the team. If we can get on radio and if we can get on TV, and also if we get on the sample ballot, which starts being distributed this weekend, I think you'll see the polling get better in our favor. But right now it's about 50-50. And again, they're preying on the confusion of community members, because if you don't know anything, if you don't read up on anything, and you go into the in there and read, there's about five or six paragraphs that are going to be on the ballot that describe issue 7. The first paragraph talks about the importance of clean energy. So if somebody just stops reading there, they're going to be like, oh, this is great, I'm going to vote yes on this.
Yeah.
If they don't read all the way through, it's not going to be good.
To your point, Dorsey, it's all in the wording. I reference right to work. And, you know, when you talk to people, oh, why don't I have the right to work? Well, wait a minute. You have to understand what right to work is all about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very clever how they phrase these. And you said a lot of dark money. Do we have any idea how much they're spending on issue 7 right now?
I have no idea yet, but I know, like I said, it's a dark money group that's going to come in. And if they can get this passed at the ballot, they're going to be looking at, you know, $85 to $90 million a year that they're going to have total control on.
Yeah.
So, and very, you know, in other cities where they've been successful, very little of that money that they've taken has gone to actually executing clean energy initiatives. It's really gone to them and how they want to spend and administer it, you know, which is, you know, after this is defeated, I think the leaders in the city got to figure out a way to change the city. I almost said the city code, but that's not it. But how legislation gets approved and stuff. I think the city charter, we have to change that so that way that this can't happen again, because we can't constantly have these fights with these dark money groups. It's too costly. It takes too much time away from some of the good things that the city is doing.
I hear you. All right, Dorsey, I got to take a quick break. Dorsey Hager joining us on our live line, as he does each and every month here on America's Workforce, columbusconstruction.org. You can follow them on Twitter at BuildCentralOH. Later in the show, Mike Nisley of the Ohio State Building Trades will be joining us. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens. Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate a 5-star rating. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Dorsey Hager on behalf of the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council. I know you want to talk about building futures and driving futures, but I want to bring up the vaccine. A couple of interesting things are happening in America right now. Well, more than a couple. I want to start off with hiring managers. And this was a survey of 1,250 hiring managers, and they found that 33% will automatically eliminate resumes that do not include a COVID-19 vaccine status. And check this out. 69% of hiring managers are more likely to hire someone who has already been vaccinated against COVID-19. 63% of companies are mandating vaccines for employees. Big story yesterday was United. United Airlines said if you don't get vaccinated, you're fired. What was it? They fired almost 600 people this week. Is that right?
I think it was 593 United employees terminated for lack of, vaccination. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, who's going to be able to fly United tomorrow? And then you read it and you see that it's actually less than 1% of their total workforce. United is huge when you figure in everybody, gate agents, travel agents, ticket takers, baggage handlers, pilots, everything else. So 99% of their employees received the vaccination because of this vaccine mandate from United. And I think that you're starting to see that more and more, where you're seeing a lot of these companies had 50, 60, 65%. They institute the vaccine mandate. And of course, you're always going to have people that are not going to want to get the vaccine for whatever reason, that they give. But I think that you're seeing these numbers really, really climb when private employers and private companies institute the vaccine mandate. I know there's a large company here in Columbus, a Fortune 500 company, that they've instituted the vaccine mandate. And November 1st is the drop dead date. You got to have your first dose on your way to full vaccination, or the people are going to be terminated without an exemption as well. So I think you're seeing it really, really, really being pushed. And I'm really surprised and amazed how the business community and the chamber has kind of wrapped their arms around this. I know, we talked about the mask mandate earlier the city of Columbus imposed, and there was a lot of small business leaders at city council who were frustrated that this was being put on them. But a lot of your regular size businesses, your large businesses, your businesses that belong to the chamber, and even the local and state chamber of commerce. It's my understanding that when House Bill 248 was getting ready to come out of committee to be voted on, which was going to basically make any mandates from private employers unconstitutional or illegal, my understanding is that the business leaders and the leaders from the chamber, state and city of Columbus, were down there at the state house lobbying Republicans, telling them, hey, I better not see your name on House Bill 248, because they didn't want it. They want their businesses to run. They want people to be safe. They want their employees to be safe. And the last thing they want is like what we saw last year in March, April, and May when everything was having to shut down. So, the Speaker, Bob Kupp, the person who was carrying House Bill 248, who was going to be able to get it out of committee, he left the bill in that committee, took her, I can't remember who introduced it, but took her off of that committee, moved it to another committee, so that bill died and never saw the light of day on the House floor. But all these things are very interesting. We're starting to deal with it here in Columbus as well. We're seeing a lot of large customers that we routinely work for mandating the vaccine. All the healthcare facilities are doing it. So if we have members that build hospitals or maintain hospitals or healthcare facilities, if they're not vaccinated, unfortunately, they're not going to be able to work in those facilities. We're having some of our unions as well, because they want their members to be safe, obviously, that are instituting cash incentives and drawings to try to, get their members vaccinated. But it's an ongoing battle. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. It's really going to be interesting to see what comes out of some of these appeals and Supreme Court decisions. I see that there's a group of teachers in Los Angeles County, which LA Schools is the largest school district in the country. 10% of the teachers there are unvaccinated, and I think their vaccine mandate goes into effect October 15th. So those teachers have filed a legal brief with the state Supreme Court in California that's we're going to wait to see if it's been heard. The Court of Appeals in New York stayed the vaccine mandate for New York public schools. So we'll see what happens there. But it's all very interesting. And here's the one thing, too, is, unless we can reach, the herd immunity through the vaccine or whatever other means possible. Like I was reading an article on Norway the other day, and they haven't had a case in months. I was reading an article on Mexico City, shockingly. You think of Mexico City, you don't think of one of the wealthiest, places on the planet. But Mexico City has a 100% mask mandate Over 80% of their residents have been vaccinated, and they haven't had a single case of COVID in months. So my thing is, where does this end? Are we going to still be doing this next year? Are we still going to be doing this in 7 years, or where are we going to be at with this? That's my thing.
Dorsey, I hear you on that. I think the tide is changing, especially with a lot of these big companies saying, hey, you better get vaccinated or you're going to be out of work. And when you're out of work, you're going to find a lot of places that are not going to hire you because you're not vaccinated. So we'll see what happens here in the next couple of months. All right, let's get into building futures, driving futures. I guess there was a recent graduation. Yeah, so what's the story on that?
Yeah, so speaking of COVID, we had to cancel our graduation a couple weeks ago because we did have an outbreak with some of our partners in building and driving futures. So, you know, to make everybody safe and to make sure that we had maximum attendance, we suspended the graduation for a couple of weeks, and then we put the building futures kids and driving futures kids together for one large graduation that was held at the Teamsters Hall. You know, the historic Teamsters Hall and iconic there in Columbus, downtown Columbus, Ohio. Great job by Josh Kincaid and Mark Van Dack, the business manager or the president and business agent of the Teamsters that helped us out with this graduation. But we combined them. We had 29 kids from both programs graduate. And this was the first time in the history of our program that not only did we graduate 100%, but we placed 100%. Before graduation. So every kid who has graduated from Building Futures has been placed, you know, either a painter or an IBW, plumber, pipe fitter, sheet metal worker, you know, insulator, whatever trade they chose that we placed them. And then all nine of the Driving Futures graduates, all nine of them have been placed. So 29 for 29 with this Building Futures and Driving Futures cohort. And that brings our statistics for the year for 59 out of 63. So we've graduated 59 kids out of 63 who have taken the classes this year, and all 59 of those have been placed. So I think our graduation rate's right around 97%, our placement rate's at 100%. We're not going to do any more building futures cohorts for the rest of the year. As of now, we're having some issues with supply chain issues with metal, steel, drywall. So while work is going great in Columbus, you know, we're a little concerned about the need for apprentices right now, so we're going to hold off. But if that changes, you know, at the flip of a switch, we could do another cohort. But for right now, there's none scheduled. But we do have another driving futures cohort scheduled to start in 2 weeks. One of our biggest union employers here in Columbus right now is offering a $12,500. It's prorated over 6 months, but a $12,500 cash sign-on bonus. And their first-year drivers are averaging right around $105,000 a year.
Wow. $12,500. Now, what do you have to be with them for a year to get that bonus then, or what?
6 months. It's paid over the first 6 months. Yeah, so
not bad.
There's tons of opportunities in Columbus, Ohio. Our Driving Futures program just continues to roll on. It's amazing how we do a cohort, you know, and there's always that little uneasiness when it starts. You know, are we going to place all these kids? And then by the end, they're all placed, and we're talking about other companies who are hearing about it and signing on and interested. And, you know, the big holiday push is going to be coming too. So we're going to have UPS, which is a huge union employer that's going to need drivers, and Teamsters. You know, Sigma is a huge employer here in Columbus, Columbus Distributing, you know, so it's a great program. I gotta hand it to Josh Kincaid and all the work he's done with the Teamsters with the Driving Futures. Kelly Harrop, our new communications director, is doing a great job running and coordinating Building Futures, and Leland Bass, the program manager over at our partner, the Columbus Urban League, and of course, all three county commissioners, Kevin Boyce, Eric Crowley, John O'Grady, and then Joy Bivens, who is works at the county as well, who oversees the program. But it's all hands on deck, and we're doing a great job. And one of the great things that I think is going to come out of it for next year too is we're looking at a mentoring program, partnering up with the NAACP and the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, you know, President Nana Watson, who I mentioned earlier in the show, and then President John Lacey from CBTU. So if we can get this mentoring program instilled, place these kids with a mentor while they're starting, while they're going through the program, and then while they're graduating, you know, not necessarily to help them out with issues on the job site or contract issues, but just help them out with you know, in life, you know, if they're having issues or if there's anything that comes up or any barriers that's keeping them from progressing and going through their apprenticeships or going through their job placements. So it's an exciting program. We're laying the groundwork right now. We're working with Mark Fluharty from the Ohio Central Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, and also John Wentz, our attorney, who also represents the Columbus Workers Center. So we're going to lay the groundwork, get this thing going. But I just think it's another tool in our toolbox to make sure that we keep tweaking this program and we keep it successful so we keep putting these kids and young people and young adults on the direct path to middle class.
Dorsey, do me a favor. Send me all the context with that, because you know that National Apprenticeship Week is coming up. I believe it's like the second week of November, and we're trying to highlight programs to get young people. And like you say it so many times, it's the pathway to the middle class. What a great opportunity here for young people, especially those in those impoverished areas. And you know there are many. There are so many. And they don't feel they have a way out, but guess what? You get involved in the trades, look out. Or driving a truck. $100,000 got my attention.
That's absolutely right. And I know I've said this before on your show, but if I go to a local high school or if I go to an association and I speak, you know, people look at me and they're like, eh, you know. But if somebody who's in the program, somebody who's graduated from the program, that's another thing that Kelly's instituting. She's instituting an alumni group so that way, current and past graduates from the program can come back and talk to the kids and work with the kids and stay in contact with them. Because I think we have 135 graduates from the program now that are out there working in different trades jobs, working for the Teamsters, working for the IBW, working for whoever. But, you know, when those kids come back and, you know, we had Charles Straley speak at graduation, a kid who was in and out of jail, you know, for some issues dealing, you know, with drugs and stuff like that. And he saw no way out and he was getting ready to turn back to that life. And then he saw a video about this program, did a great job, graduated. He's placed with the team, the iron workers now. I think he's a third year iron worker. And he's, like he said, this job has changed his life because of the pay and benefits it provided him and given him the opportunity to get right into the middle class.
Doesn't get any better than that, no doubt. All right, my friend, we're going to leave it on that note. Dorsey Hager, Executive Director of the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, and the Twitter handle, BuildCentralOH. You take care. We'll talk to you in a month, my brother. All right?
All right. Thank you so much. Hey, go Browns. We got to keep the momentum rolling. We got to beat the Vikings Sunday. So I'll leave it with that. Go Browns, beat the Vikings.